The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. Our April edition of Smithsonian has not come in the mail yet, so I'm reading from Smithsonian.com. Women Who Shaped History. A pillar of the Smithsonian's mission is to tell the lesser-known stories of those who made the present possible. For Women's History Month, Smithsonian.com has collected representative examples of its coverage of diverse women throughout history. Ultimately, this is a journey not just of American women, but of America herself. The unsung inspiration behind the real Rosie the Riveter. Historians pay tribute to the legacy of Naomi Parker Fraley, who died at 96. In 2015, she was linked circumstantially to the We Can Do It poster by Bridget Katz. In 1942, something strange and mildly scandalous happened at the Naval Air Station in Alameda, California. Due to safety concerns, the base commander instructed all women employees working with machinery to wear pantsuits. At the time, pants-clad women were such an unusual sight that a photojournalist from the Acme Photo Agency was sent to document the scene. While taking pictures at the base, the photographer snapped a picture of 20-year-old Naomi Parker Fraley, who, like many women in the 1940s, had taken an industrial job to help with the war effort. In the resulting black-and-white image, which was published widely in the spring and summer of 1942, Fraley leans intently over a metalworking lathe used to produce duplicate parts. Her blouse is crisp, her hair secured safely in a polka-dot bandana. Fraley, who died at the age of 96, stayed out of the spotlight for most of her long life. But several years before her death, a scholar put forth a compelling case arguing that the photo of Fraley at the Naval Air Station had inspired one of the most iconic images to emerge from the World War II era, the vibrant We Can Do It poster, which features a defiant Rosie the Riveter with her bicep curled and her hair wrapped up in a polka-dot bandana, not unlike the one Fraley wore on the job. Fraley, in other words, might very well have been the real Rosie the Riveter. If Fraley lived much of her life in obscurity, it is in part because nobody was looking for her. Though the We Can Do It poster has in recent years become a ubiquitous feminist symbol, it was first created as a wartime poster for the Westinghouse Electric Corporation's plants. William L. Byrd, a curator at the National Museum of American History and co-author of the book Design for Victory, tells Smithsonian.com that industrial companies frequently ran poster campaigns with various instructions for new women employees. Return your tools at the end of the day. Don't take too many breaks. Keep the workplace clean. And so on. These were basically a way that factory managers were able to routinize their labor force so that the many women who had not had factory jobs before because they weren't available would be acquainted with how to do things here, Byrd explains. The We Can Do It poster was drawn by Pittsburgh-based artist J. Howard Miller, who created a series of images for Westinghouse. One illustration that has not stood the test of time, for instance, featured a bespectacled man holding rolled-up blueprints with a caption that reads, "Any questions about your work? Ask your supervisor." The We Can Do It poster, with its electric yellow background and robust Rosie, is considerably more arresting. But, Byrd points out, its intent didn't have much to do with empowering people in terms of anything, other than to complete assignments on time. Miller's poster was circulated in Westinghouse factories during the war and subsequently disappeared. But in the 1980s, the National Archives in Washington featured a copy of the We Can Do It poster in one of its exhibits, and according to Byrd, began to merchandise that image on all manner of paraphernalia in their shop. After seeing the National Archives exhibit, Byrd acquired an original We Can Do It poster from Miller for the Smithsonian, and Miller's industrial illustration was soon adopted as a symbol of aspiration and resilience for women. Many years would pass before Fraley's name surfaced in connection to the iconic image. Instead, Miller's Rosie was believed to have been based on a woman named Geraldine Hoff Doyle, who had worked as a metal presser in a Michigan plant during the war. In 1984, Doyle was thumbing through Maturity magazine when she came across the 1942 photo of a young woman standing over an industrial lathe. Doyle thought she recognized herself in the image. 10 years later, Doyle saw an issue of Smithsonian magazine that featured the We Can Do It poster on its cover and was convinced that this illustration was based on the photo of her at work in a wartime factory. Soon it was being wildly reported that Doyle had been the inspiration for Miller's Rosie. But James J. Kimball, an associate professor at New Jersey Seton Hall University, wasn't so sure. When Doyle died in 2010 and a stream of obituaries touted her as the real Rosie the Riveter, Kimball saw an opportunity to try and find out how we really know it was Geraldine, he tells Smithsonian. And if it wasn't, who was? Kimball pored through books, magazines, and the Internet, hoping to find a captioned version of the 1942 photograph. And finally, he located a copy of the image at a vintage photo dealer. As Joel Gunter of the BBC reports, the picture was captured with a date, March 24, 1942. The place where it was taken, Alameda, California, and much to Kimball's excitement, an identifying caption. Quote, "Pretty Naomi Parker looks like she might catch her nose in the turret lathe she is operating," the text reads. Assuming that Fraley had died, Kimball enlisted the help of a genealogical society to track down her descendants. "They sent me a letter after 2 or 3 months of doing their own sleuthing," Kimball recalls, and the letter said something like, "Jim, we have to stop working on this case because we can't provide information on people who are still alive. We have every reason to believe she is. Just imagine that moment when everything is turned on its head and I realize this woman may actually be out there somewhere." In 2015, Kimball visited Fraley, who was living with her sister, Ada Wynn Parker Loy, in a remote wooded area of Redding, California. After the war, according to Margalit Fox of the New York Times, Fraley worked as a waitress at the Dollhouse, a popular California establishment, got married, and had a family. For decades, she kept a clipping of the wire photo that had been taken of her as a young woman at the Naval Air Station in Alameda. Kimball says that when she showed up on Fraley's doorstep, she greeted him with a huge sense of relief. In 2011, Fraley and her sister had attended a reunion of women wartime workers at the Rosie the Riveter/World War II Homefront National Historical Park in Richmond, California. For the first time, Fraley saw the We Can Do It poster displayed alongside the 1942 wire photo, which identified its subject as Geraldine Hoff Doyle. Fraley tried to alert National Park Service officials to the error, but was unable to convince them to change the attribution. After Kimball went public with the results of his research, Matthew Hansen of the Omaha World Herald contacted Fraley for an interview. Because Fraley was very hard of hearing during the last years of her life, they spoke over the phone with Ada's help. Hansen asked how it felt to be known as Rosie the Riveter. "Victory," Fraley could be heard yelling in the background. "Victory! Victory!" Admittedly, the evidence connecting the photo of Fraley to the We Can Do It poster is circumstantial. J. Howard Miller never revealed the inspiration for his now famous illustration. But, Kimball says, it is entirely plausible that Miller's Rosie was based on Fraley. "They look like each other," he explains. "There's a polka dot bandana. The timing is right. We know the 1942 photo appeared in the Pittsburgh Press, which is where Miller lived. It's a good guess." Throughout his 6-year quest to uncover the true history of the We Can Do It poster, Kimball was propelled forward by the desire to correct a historical error, an error that omitted the important role one woman made to the war effort. At a certain point in time, for 3 or 4 years, Naomi Parker Fraley is disempowered, Kimball explains. Her identity has been taken away from her. Innocently, but nonetheless, she feels disempowered. So it was important, I think, to correct the record for that reason alone. He takes comfort that Miller's poster, or at least what Miller's poster has come to stand for in the decades after the war, has gone on to transcend the identity of a single person. I think our culture ought to value what those women did, those Rosies, those riveters, and those many women who are not named Rosie, who didn't rivet, and nonetheless contributed to the war effort, he says. Naomi is important because she is one of them. Another timely short story from Smithsonian.com, Why the True Story of Chappaquiddick is Impossible to Tell. In 1969, Senator Ted Kennedy careened a car off a bridge, killing passenger Mary Jo Kopechne. But the story of the night's events remain muddled today. By Lorraine Boisenault, Smithsonian.com. Mary Jo Kopechne was a 28-year-old when she attended a party on Chappaquiddick Island, a tiny spit near Martha's Vineyard, on July 18, 1969. Joined by five of her friends from the 1968 presidential campaign for Senator Robert F. Kennedy, Kopechne had already made waves in Democratic circles in Washington, working for a Florida senator before moving to Kennedy's Senate staff. She proved herself adept by helping to write an anti-Vietnam War speech for RFK and helped write the address announcing his ill-fated candidacy for president. Edward Ted Kennedy, meanwhile, was the last surviving son of Joseph Kennedy at the time of the party. After the wartime death of Joseph Jr. and the assassination of John and Robert, Ted remained as the political leader of the family, a sitting U.S. senator from Massachusetts with a potential run at the presidency in his future. As host of the party in question, Ted brought the women together for a reunion that included Kennedy's cousin, Joseph Gargan, and former U.S. attorney from Massachusetts, Paul Markham. By the end of the night, the festivities had turned tragic. Kennedy's car overturned on a small bridge and landed upside down in the water. While Kennedy survived, Kopechne, his passenger, drowned. What happened on that bridge? Was Kennedy drinking and driving? What were he and Kopechne doing together alone in the first place? The details at the time were, as they say now, sparse. It would be a full 10 hours before Kennedy reported the incident to local police. It's the story of this night that would become an enduring black mark on Kennedy's political career, and that served as fodder for the new film Chappaquiddick, starring Jason Clarke as Ted Kennedy. The scandal haunted him and the Democratic Party for decades, and was also blamed for ruining his presidential prospects. Kennedy, for his part, claimed in his autobiography that it was not a detriment to his decision to run for president in 1980. Screenwriters Taylor Allen and Andrew Logan felt the drama was the perfect subject for a film about the disposability of women, the impossible expectations of the Kennedy family, how power gets abused, and the role of the media in hiding or exposing political scandal. Although they don't claim complete veracity for the film, director John Curran says he wasn't interested in making a documentary on the incident. All three men strove to hew as closely as possible to actual events. Logan and Allen based their script on the nearly 1,000-page inquest released by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in 1970. The two people who really know what happened that night are dead, Ted and Mary Jo, Curran says. And the others around them, the ones that are still alive, they aren't going to say anything. Part of the reason details are so spotty comes from those 10 hours of waiting to report the accident. Why didn't Kennedy contact authorities sooner? He would later claim he was suffering from physical and emotional shock and not thinking clearly. And then there was talk of a cover-up, of Kennedy and his press team attempting to downplay the incident so as not to harm his future political aspirations. Sometimes I'd like to scream a lot, but I'm trying to hold it back, said Gwen Kopechne, the mother of Mary Jo, to the Boston Globe. It would be nice if somebody spoke up. But she also told McCall's magazine that she believed Kennedy had been behaving erratically after the accident due to shock and a minor concussion. what she didn't understand, or how Garrigan and Markham, Kennedy's aides, who also attempted to retrieve Mary Jo from the car after the accident, didn't report the accident or force Ted to do so. Garrigan and Markham not only failed to get immediate help, but also let the senator swim back alone to report the accident from Edgartown, the elder Kopechne said. This is the big hurt, the nightmares we have to live with for the rest of our lives, that Mary Jo was left in the water for 9 hours. She didn't belong there. No one ever provided the answer she wanted. In the immediate aftermath of the car accident, the nation and the media were largely distracted by the Apollo 11 moon landing. It was the greatest moment in John F. Kennedy's presidential legacy, happening at the worst possible moment for Ted Kennedy, the senator's potential legacy, Allen says. That backdrop of an already distracted news media provided Ted's team with time for damage control and further obscured the truth about what actually happened. But once the moon landing receded from the immediate news cycle, the story of Kennedy and Kopechne exploded. Curran and his producers attempted to capture the media coverage by intercutting archival news footage and newspaper headlines throughout the narrative. The film also emphasizes the strain it put on Kennedy's wife, Joan, who was pregnant at the time. She ultimately suffered a miscarriage, which she blamed on the incident. At the same time, she told the wire service, United Press International, "I believe everything Ted said." She didn't pay heed to allegations that Kennedy and Kopechne were going for a midnight swim when the accident happened. This fervor for more details about what exactly happened and whether some misconduct had occurred between the married men and single women the night of the party was also experienced by those who attended the party the night of Kopechne's death. Among them were Susan Tannenbaum, who also worked on Robert Kennedy's campaign staff. "You can't begin to understand what it's been like," Tannenbaum later said. "I place a tremendous value on the right of privacy, but suddenly I'm infamous. The real meaning of what you are and what you value remains intact inside you, but there you are, splashed all over the papers. How would you feel if a reporter called your mother at 8 a.m. and asked whether she approved of her daughter's conduct in spending the night with a group of married men?" That aspect of the accident particularly galled the screenwriters. In an era when women were only beginning to enter the workforce in high numbers, press coverage only added to their objectification. Kopechne was an intelligent, strong woman who worked for the Bobby Kennedy campaign in a high capacity and did really great work, including transcribing and then adding to the speech he gave about Vietnam, Allen says. In the end, Kennedy appeared in court and pleaded guilty to a charge of leaving the scene of an accident. Judge Jane Boyle sentenced Kennedy to the minimum punishment for the offense, 2 months incarceration, but Kennedy never served jail time, as the judge suspended the sentence. He has already been and will continue to be punished far beyond anything this court can impose. The ends of justice will be satisfied by the imposition of the minimum jail sentence and the suspension of that sentence, assuming the defendant accepts the suspension, Boyle said, with the result that the suspension was accepted by the defense team. No public inquest into the death occurred, and Kennedy went on to make a televised speech about the accident. The speech is one of the few scenes in which the writers of Chappaquiddick took liberties with the facts of the case. In the movie, Kennedy cousin Joe Garrigan unsuccessfully tries to convince Ted to read a resignation letter rather than going on television. We have no evidence in the research to back that up, although it's evident that it was considered, Allen says. Since then, the Chappaquiddick incident has been used repeatedly as a go-to insult by conservative politicians, particularly when one of their own came under the microscope of a D.C. scandal in Faith Whittlesey. A Pennsylvania Republican and White House staff member under President Reagan recalled thinking the incident would be the end of Kennedy and that he could block from the presidency for the rest of his career. The story was occasionally resurrected to point to the questions that remain unanswered, even as Kennedy remained in the Senate until his death in 2009. Though Curran was nervous about taking on someone whose political achievements he admired, especially since there continued to be numerous conspiracy theories about the accident, including a third person was in the car, he felt the task to be a necessary one. Whether you're on the left or right side of the aisle, it's imperative that we take a pretty hard, unvarnished look at our heroes these days, Curran says. The time is done to let all these guys skate by. I think if this story happened now, it would overshadow the moon landing. But in 1969, the reverse proved true. The closing scene of Chappaquiddick features a bit of archival footage from a man on the street style interview in Boston. A reporter asked one person after another whether they would still consider voting for Kennedy after the Chappaquiddick accident. They answer, many, resoundingly, with a yes. Well, it is Boston, after all. And we have time to partially read a story on who was Mary Magdalene. The first thing to do in unraveling the tapestry of Mary Magdalene is to tease out the threads that properly belong to these other women. Some of these threads are quite knotted, and these are other women in the Gospels. It will help to remember how the story that includes them all came to be written. The four Gospels are not eyewitness accounts. They were written 35 to 65 years after Jesus' death, a gelling of separate oral traditions that had taken form in dispersed Christian communities. Jesus died in about the year A.D. 30. The Gospels of Mark, Matthew, and Luke date to about 65 to 85 and have sources and themes in common. The Gospel of John was composed around 90 to 95 and is distinct. So when we read about Mary Magdalene in each of the Gospels, as when we read about Jesus, what we are getting is not history, but memory. Memory shaped by time, by shades of emphasis, and by efforts to make distinctive theological points. And already, even in the early period, as is evident when the varied accounts are measured against each other, the memory is blurred. Regarding Mary of Magdala, the confusion begins in the 8th chapter of Luke. Now after this, Jesus made his way through towns and villages, preaching and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God. With him went the 12, as well as certain women who had been cured of evil spirits and ailments. Mary, surnamed the Magdalene, from whom 7 demons had gone out. Joanna, the wife of Herod's steward Chuza, Susanna, and several others who provided for them out of their own resources. Two things of note are implied in this passage. First, these women provided for, in quotes, Jesus and the 12, which suggests that the women were well-to-do, respectable figures. It is possible this was an attribution to Jesus' time of a role prosperous women played some years later. Second, they all had been cured of something, including Mary Magdalene. The 7 demons, as applied to her, indicates an ailment, not necessarily possession, of a certain severity. Soon enough, as the blurring work of memory continued, and then as the written gospel was read by Gentiles unfamiliar with such coded language, those demons would be taken as a sign of moral infirmity. This otherwise innocuous reference to Mary Magdalene takes on a kind of radioactive narrative energy, because of what immediately precedes it at the end of the 7th chapter, an anecdote of stupendous power. One of the Pharisees invited Jesus to a meal. When he arrived at the Pharisee's house and took his place at table, a woman came in who had a bad name in the town. She had heard he was dining with the Pharisee and had brought with her an alabaster jar of ointment. She waited behind him at his feet, weeping, and her tears fell on his feet, and she wiped them away with her hair. Then she covered his feet with kisses and anointed them with ointment. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who this woman is that is touching him and what a bad name she has. But Jesus refuses to condemn her or even deflect her gesture. Indeed, he recognizes it as a sign that her many sins must have been forgiven her, or she would not have shown such great love. Your faith has saved you, Jesus tells her. Go in peace. The story of the woman with the bad name, the alabaster jar, the loose hair, the, quote, many sins, the stricken conscience, the ointment, the rubbing of feet, and the kissing would, over time, become the dramatic high point in the story of Mary Magdalene. The scene would be explicitly attached to her and rendered again and again by the greatest Christian artists. But even a casual reading of this text, however charged its juxtaposition with the subsequent verses, suggests that the two women have nothing to do with each other, that the weeping anointer is no more connected to Mary of Magdala than she is to Joanna or Susanna. Other voices in the Gospel only add to the complexity. Matthew gives an account of the same incident, for example, but to make a different point and with a crucial detail added. Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper when a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of the most expensive ointment and poured it on his head as he was at the table. When they saw this, the disciples were indignant. "Why this waste?" they said. "This could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor." Jesus noticed this. "Why are you upsetting the woman?" he said to them. "When she poured this ointment on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. I tell you solemnly, wherever in all the world this good news is proclaimed, what she has done will be told, also in remembrance of her." This passage shows what scripture scholars commonly call the telephone game character of the oral tradition from which the Gospels grew. Instead of Luke's Pharisee, whose name is Simon, we find in Matthew Simon the leper. Most tellingly, this anointing is specifically referred to as the traditional rubbing of a corpse with oil, so the act is an explicit foreshadowing of Jesus' death. In Matthew and in Mark, the story of the unnamed woman puts her acceptance of Jesus' coming death in glorious contrast to the disciples' refusal to take Jesus' predictions of his death seriously. But in other passages, Mary Magdalene is associated by name with the burial of Jesus, which helps explain why it is easy to confuse this anonymous woman with her. Indeed, with this incident, both Matthew's and Mark's narratives begin the move toward the climax of the crucifixion, because one of the disciples, the man called Judas, goes in the very next verse to the chief priests to betray Jesus. In the passage about the anointings, the woman is identified by the alabaster jar. But in Luke, with no reference to the death ritual, there are clear erotic overtones. A man of that time was to see a woman's loosened hair only in the intimacy of the bedroom. The offense taken by witnesses in Luke concerns sex, while in Matthew and Mark it concerns money, and in Luke the woman's tears together with Jesus' words define the encounter as one of abject repentance. That's the sound. Our time is up. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.